Democrats love policy. They love to tell you, well, on page 147 of my policy plan concerning climate change, you'll discover tab 2. And tab 2 contains 84 recommendations. Stop it. Cut it out. Stop it. Donald Trump's policy was, I will hate the people you hate. Barack Obama's policy was hope and change. What's the similarity between those two men? Morally, nothing. Politically, simple, successful messaging. Crisp, clear, basic, funny, sharp, witty. Not ponderous, philosophical, judgmental, bitchy, whiny.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to the Lincoln Project podcast. So the other day on the Enemies List podcast, I did a special Q&A session, and people absolutely loved it. We asked them to send us questions, and I got so many questions for that one. And I know that the Lincoln Project audience has also, there's a big overlap. And so I wanted to answer some of the questions we've gotten in for the Lincoln Info account and some of the other ones that have come in to me, because I think we might make this a regular thing. I think we might make this a consistent sort of, you know, maybe once a month or once every 6 weeks, we'll do a Q&A podcast. And by the way, if you have questions you want to ask in the future, email podcast@lincolnproject.us, and we will be very excited to answer these burning questions head on. So right at the top, will we even have free and fair elections, or frankly, presidential elections in the future? He controls the Senate, the House, and the SCOTUS. He's talked openly about admiring leaders who are presidents as long as they want, and even recently brought up getting a third term. Honestly, I don't have any hopes for the midterms either. He can do a lot of effing damage in 2 years. I'm 61 and I'm so afraid I won't live to see this country turn back around in my lifetime. It's so hard to retain hope. Rauschus, I get it. That is something that autocrats love, is to have the formalized structure of elections but not really do elections. This is still not quite in his power to the degree he would like it to be. It is still, at this point, the states still run their elections. Federalism is alive and well when it comes to states running their electoral processes. And so I think it's going to take him a while on that front. Now, can he cause all kinds of problems in this space? Sure. Is he out saying to people, you know, you will never have to vote again? Sure. We get a vote in this one. And I'll tell you some good news so you can have a little bit of hope. Not too much. I don't like people getting ahead of themselves. 2026. Right now, the House is a very narrow margin for the Republicans. They're just clinging by the skin of their teeth. 2026 is coming up fast. I know we had an election 5 minutes ago, but by the middle of next year, people are going to be deciding how they're going to run, what they're going to run for. By the beginning of the year after that, by the beginning of 2026, the Republicans will basically be done doing the damage they can do in the short term. It's going to be tough for them to pass much stuff after that, especially because in the Senate, they have a lot of vulnerabilities coming up on the 26 election cycle. We have to be diligent. We have to always punch back. We can't take any time off. We can't rest or relax on this stuff, but we are going to keep fighting in that fight. And when it comes to your state, your state still runs it. If it's a red state, they may be running it in a way that is more onerous, requires more voter ID, purges voter rolls. It's why I always tell folks, yes, your vote for president is really important, but your vote for county commissioner and your vote for state rep and your vote for your local sheriff, those are damn important too. Keep up with that. And keep hoping, because the midterms, there really is a big argument that the midterms can be somewhere where we go to war with them and have a success. Okay. So Stacey Fishkin asks, how do you stay calm and positive in the coming disaster? And she said, you know, that she had found some solace in me saying that Trump doesn't do everything he says he's going to do. Too many people played pick your own adventure with the Trump promises. They're happy to say, I'll vote for him because I want immigration stop, but he won't do the tariffs and something along those lines. You were right, Stacey. That mindset did kind of screw us in 2024. But one of the things that you're right in this about, Stacey, is we can't let the Republicans play pick your own adventure. We do have to define them. We have to describe them. And when I say Republicans, folks, I do not mean the old Republican Party you think you know. I mean the new MAGA incarnation of the Republican Party. It is a big problem. And look, I believe very strongly in the power of narrative and stories and descriptive language. As they go forward doing these things that are crazy and conspiratorial and cruel and weird and wicked and awful, Democrats shouldn't hesitate to describe them in the language that is real and that effectively communicates what's really happening. Too often they're like, my honorable colleague is mistaken on this policy. No, no. It's, yo, dude, you're going to kill people if you do that. Yo, dude, that sucks. Getting down into a more granular and crisp communication style is something I really want to encourage our Democratic friends to do. It's important. It would be helpful and it'd be smart to do. And Stacey, you know, you said, I really believed in your belief we were going to win this. And I, Stacey, believe me, if I had any other thing I could have done, anything else I could have done, our organization left it all on the table. I personally left it all on the table. Everybody has the perfect clarity of hindsight about how to win or lose a race, how things really happened. What was the, this race was tough and things were drawn out of the low propensity voter pool with Trump that no one in their polling, us included, saw coming. Here we are. But the fight goes on and we're going to keep pushing forward. Mark Livingston asked, in a recent podcast with Tal Yulevin, she used a term they've been thinking about recently, theocratic autocracy. Many terms have been used to describe the goal, right-wing Christian extremist, for example, dominionism, Christian fascism, white Christian nationalism, etc. Project 2020 had formed this in plain language that the goal is a theocratic autocracy. And he points out that the other place we've heard that is Iran. And yes, there is a movement in the country among a sect of evangelicals, among a part of the evangelical movement. It's not even the whole evangelical movement, this Christian dominionism. And it is profoundly anti and constitutional. The idea that evangelical Christianity should be a central pillar of our governance is, and again, conservatives, remember those founders you love so much, is so antithetical to what the founders intended. They quite literally were the product of people fleeing to America to avoid a state-run religious system. And yes, it does look a lot like Iran when you think about that. It does look a lot like it does look a lot like the idea of these Muslim theocracies that you see, you know, around the world at to greater or lesser degrees. Iran is probably the alpha case, but you certainly see the influence of a singular religious groups in other countries, the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia. But the problem with all those other countries is their constitutions aren't wired like the American Constitution. The First Amendment is very specific about this. And the difficulty that I think a lot of these dominionists have, and yes, the white Christian nationalism is wrapped up in the white nationalism, but a lot of the dominionists are motivated by the idea that government and culture are their opponents, and that those the government and culture are the enemies of God. Look, I don't think it's their place to decide, you know, who God's enemies are. But I don't think it conforms at all to our Constitution. And it doesn't really even conform to the traditional role of Christianity and culture and society.
But look, they're out there. They are very feisty right now. They're very jazzed up right now. A lot of Project 2025 is infused with some of that theory and that thinking. And it's dangerous. And you know, the way to stand up to it is to make sure that we hold firm on the Constitution, because they're allowed to believe whatever they want to believe. They're allowed to even advocate whatever they want to advocate under the First Amendment, short of violence. But the First Amendment is very clear, and the Constitution is abundantly clear. And the history of the founding is abundantly clear. We are not a Christian nation. We are not a religious state. That's it. It's a red line. It's a bottom line. And for those that think it's not, you are welcome to go live somewhere where there is a religious theocracy. Enjoy. Have fun. Do it. Okay. Sean Hussey writes, love your work. I hope to be a Republican again one day. I don't really fit in with the Dems. I see their goal. I don't see them as evil. I want to compromise with them. First, the radical right needs to be evicted. No authoritarianism, no blind religious devotion. Transparency, limited government, balanced budget, reduce the debt to 50% of GDP. We'll never get there until the echo chamber is cracked open. Damn, Sean, that's good. Okay? And look, folks, let's be real. For those of you in the audience who are more progressive, I honor your decisions and your philosophy. It's great. America is a largely center-right country. And the things that Sean just described were the things that at least the old Republican Party aspirationally tried to get to. They at least aspirationally tried for limited government or balanced budgets. Now, they failed over and over, but at least they were explicit and aspirational about saying those things, in part because a lot of Americans, the vast majority of Americans, believe those things. Now, what the Republican Party is today is authoritarian and cult-like and all those other things. You know the drill. You get it. None of that can happen, well, as long as Donald Trump still has the centrality of power he has in the Republican Party. Could there be or should there be a center-right party in the country? I absolutely think there should be. I think one-party states of either party lead to corruption and inefficiency and an insularity that isn't good. But look, I mean, God, the idea that there are millions of Americans who would like a center-right party, and an awful lot of them are those sort of traditional, more, I know you're going to, some of y'all are going to get your hackles up, Bush Republicans and Reagan Republicans who want a strong foreign policy and who want a strong economy and free-ish markets. And they're not really into all the social control stuff. One of the things I think that is self-limiting about Trumpism is that it is all about the social control. It is all about the we'll tell you how to live thing. You know, the party that used to be about limited government is now the party that's about maximal government. Now the party that's about enormous government. And I think there's an opportunity here for the Democrats to capture some voters in the center, or at some point for an emergent center-right party. And it would be a minority party for a while, guys. I got to be honest about it. It would be a minority party for quite some time. But that minority party could end up in the old 1854 scenario. The Whig Party was the dominant political party in America until the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854, where they voted to expand slavery or to allow slavery to expand into currently free states and territories. It destroyed their party. What emerged was the party that was about liberty. That was the Republican Party. They wanted to free the slaves, and they were about liberty and abolition. Do you have a scenario where that happens in America with another third party? It's hard to say. They're very, very, very difficult to launch because most third parties try to start at the top and win a presidential race. That's idiotic. The way a third party should start is at the grassroots, is at local races, county commissioner, school board, sheriff. Do we need one? Yeah. Is the Republican Party one? No. Am I the guy to start a new one? I don't think so, but let's keep talking. It's a good question. Casey writes,
At what point does someone's support for Donald Trump stop being about policy objectives and become about the cruelty? At what point does their support for a man become a moral reflection upon them as a person? Is there a point at which we have to write off folks who are lost to the cult? Or is there some obscure path forward here? Casey, this is a really hard question for folks. The cruelty, as Adam Serwer famously said, is the point of Trumpism. And Tim Snyder's new book on freedom has a little chapter that I thought was just the perfect summation of what Trumpism is. He called it sadopopulism. It's not enough to have the populist rhetoric and the sort of swaggering, we're tough guys, we're the manly men, all that stuff. It's not enough for them to do that. They want to see other people suffer. Why do they want to deport 25 million people? So that you will have a spectacle of visible cruelty. Why do they want to do that? So that you will see it and understand that they have power and will use it. Why is it that they want to punish trans kids who are a very tiny, tiny number of Americans, but they still have all the civil rights that every other American has? Why do they want to punish them? Because it is a way for them to engage in a pleasurable activity in the pain of others. Sadopopulism is such a brilliant phrase. I told Tim on an interview the day how envious I was he had coined that. And it is so on the money. It's so on point. It's so there as a reflection of their character. And is every single Trump supporter a sadopopulist? No. A lot of them are what I call casually evil. Those people are willing to say, well, I want the tax cuts, and I want regulation cuts, and I want cheaper gas and cheaper eggs. So I'm okay with the lavish, ludicrous, demonstrative spectacle of cruelty. I'm okay with watching people get hurt. I'm okay with the language, the tone, the shittiness. And, you know, there is nothing in this world more delicate than a tough guy Trumper. There's nothing in this world that the people who say, fuck your feelings all the time, when you poke them, they immediately flip into a complete panic and rage. How dare you speak to me that way, you scoundrel? Sadopopulism and the cruelty of Trumpism disguises personal weakness. It disguises a lack of confidence in yourself, in your education, in your status in society, in your position in the world, in your role as a family member, as a leader, or in the community, any of these things. It's about weakness. They've been fed a diet of weakness for years. Trumpism is a fundamentally pessimistic and weak philosophy. It always has things in it. Think about it for a second. Well, they control everything, and they are doing this to us, and they are the ones who cause my suffering. I didn't have to take up OxyContin, but they made it too easy for me. My job was great until they took it over. There's always a they. There's always a dark force out in the firmament somewhere. And the truth is, the Republican Party I came from had this thing about personal responsibility. And that has just disappeared. And that's what empowers them to engage in this sort of, like I said, this public cruelty, this demonstrative cruelty. If you have people like that in your life, don't feed the monster. Just don't. Don't fight with them. They want you to fight with them. Don't say, how dare you? You're a sexist, racist. But they want that. They love that stuff. They love that stuff. When they say something to you like that, the response is very simple. Just look at him and say, did you mean to say that? And just dead-eye it. Did you mean to say that? Because very frequently, they've built it up in their mind, like, I'm going to own that lib cousin of mine, or I'm going to own that lib friend. And if you don't respond with a visceral, emotional upset, they can't handle it. They lose their damn minds. They lose their damn minds. And, you know, look, people who have family members who are Trumpist, it's hard. I know it's hard, folks. I get it. I understand it. because these people say things that are amazingly cruel and amazingly shitty. You don't have to accept it. You don't have to accept the predicate of it. You don't have to try to litigate it with them. Part of Trumpism, by the way, is the death of reason. So they're not saying these things to you in a way that is supposed to be an intellectually constructed argument. They're saying it to you to upset you and piss you off, because lib-owning and nastiness, and again, as Adam Serwer famously said, the cruelty for them is the point. Great. Great question, Casey. So here's a question from Sarah. I'm a lifelong Democrat living in Louisiana, which recently changed its open primary system to closed. Yeah, Louisiana used to have a jungle primary. Now it's a closed primary. Should I change my party affiliation to Republican in order to be able to vote in the Republican primary, which is frequently where the direction of the general election is decided? For background, Bill Cassidy, who voted to convict Trump in the second impeachment, will be up for re-election in 2026 if he decides to run. I want him to get at least into the general. Either way, love your insights. Yes. If you're in a deep, 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 deep red state, okay, and you know how you're going to vote in the general, and you want to jump in and play fuck around in their primary, God bless. I think we should have open primaries in this country, but that's just me. Look, and it's the sort of thing they'll do. Trust me, I would do it. Good question, Sarah. Oh, here's a great one. Craig Davis writes, Rick, I really enjoyed today's Q&A podcast. Well, here we are at another one. My question for a future episode is this. What happens if Donald Trump passes away during his term? How does a Vance administration differ from a Trump administration, politically, legislatively, and in terms of media or tone or anything else you could think that would be different? Thanks for all you do. Well, look, I think that the actuarial tables and McDonald's give us pretty decent odds that Donald Trump will not wake up one morning and there will be a kerfuffle in the White House. Here's the thing about J.D. Vance. I used to think about J.D. Vance as a guy who had betrayed all of the things he said he believed in and had walked away from his philosophical predicates and principles, and that he somehow had transformed himself into this Trumpish sky. But what I've realized is that there is no J.D. Vance. There is no there. There is no man there. There is this cavernous, yawning chasm of need. What we can ascribe that to his upbringing or his screwed up life or whatever you want to do. But there is no real like Vance qua Vance. I think I've used qua twice in one show. Sorry about that, folks. That tricky classical education. He doesn't believe in much at all. He conforms himself to the group he's in and transforms himself into, he's the talented Mr. Ripley. He understands that imitating the folkways and attitudes and gestures and language of the people he's around was his way of overcoming his imposter syndrome and all that other garbage. So what happens on election day? On funeral day. They wake up, Donald Trump's assuming room temperature up in the Lincoln bed or up in the residence. And they say, Mr. Vance, you are now president. Well, the first phone call is going to come from people like Peter Thiel, who is Vance's financial and political sugar daddy. And you're going to have this moment of absolutely stunned reaction in the country, because a lot of people will be asking they're going to be asking your question. It will be much more Project 2025. It will be much more, assertively technocratic. There will be fewer dramatic Trumpian moments. I don't think Vance would be a particularly good president because he doesn't have a firm internal set of beliefs. Trump was a bad president the first time because he doesn't really believe in anything. He believes in Trump. He believes in himself. He believes in the centrality of his ego and his avarice and his lusts and whatever. Vance will be surrounded by a lot of the same people. I think that he will have a hard time attracting the same love of the MAGA cult that Trump has always commanded. I think he will have a great difficulty if he makes any changes that feel off the axis of Trump, because the entire MAGA media ecosystem is built to enforce the cult. And even in death, the cult will be powerful. There's a North Korean thing called Juche, right? And it's basically the rules of the personality cult of the Kim family. So the Little Rocket Man, as Trump calls him, is the third generation of Kims. They have now assumed over three generations, and actually four generations of Koreans. No one alive today in Korea has not been a under the grip of the Kims. And no one remembers the before times. The Trump cult will try to be like that, which is why I think the minute the J.D. Vance is president, after Donald Trump, joins the choir invisible, or is running the jet ski stand on the Lake of Fire, is more likely, Donald Trump Jr. is going to announce that he's going to run for president. You're going to immediately have this J.D. Vance is the pretender. He's the prince regent instead of the vice president. I think you will immediately see him get into a kind of a deep hole. I don't think it'll go well for him. I think it's going to be very quickly kind of ugly. I don't think he's going to have a great time with it. I think there's a real argument to be made that Vance will have a disastrous moment. And we haven't had a lot of folks. I mean, look, Harry Truman and LBJ and Gerald Ford in the last 100 years. And in the case of LBJ, terrible externality. In the case of Gerald Ford, terrible externality. In the case of Truman, death. But I don't think Vance has as easy a skate in the world as he might think and as others might think if he somehow becomes president. So I've got one more here today. After the podcast with John Albon, I had to write, I live in rural Michigan. The way people who voted for Trump think was depicted so accurately. How to combat it? How can we, and I'm willing to volunteer my time, get messages in simple words plastered everywhere in rural sports spots? I remember when Rush hit the airwaves, my dad, an otherwise nice guy, was taken in hard. The hate is not the issue. It's the simplicity. You guys have the best messages. Thanks, Ingrid. That's a great question, Ingrid, and it really is speaking to a lot of the discussions we're having behind the scenes at LP right now, is the disinformation machine that has reshaped America for Trump, it does use incredibly simplistic, clear language, emotionally evocative language. The head is beaten by the heart all the time. I think one of the things that I've identified in the past and other folks as well is that Democrats love policy. They love to tell you, well, on page 147 of my policy plan concerning climate change, you'll discover tab 2. And tab 2 contains 84 recommendations. Stop it. Cut it out. Stop it. Donald Trump's policy was, I will hate the people you hate. Barack Obama's policy was hope and change. What's the similarity between those two men? Morally, nothing. Politically, simple. Successful messaging. Crisp, clear, basic, funny, sharp, witty. Not ponderous, philosophical, judgmental, bitchy, whiny. I think you're going to see in our communications going forward maybe a little less fun and funny, maybe a little less expecting everybody to get the internal joke. But I think you're going to see a lot more emotionally evocative language. And that's something that's important right now. Because Trump scared the shit out of Americans who voted for him. Unless you vote for me,
the Mexicans will rape you. Unless you vote for me, they'll take your job. Unless you vote for me, they'll kidnap your kids and change their sex in school. Unless you vote for me, the trans people win. All of this stuff was expressed emotionally. That emotion was fear and loathing. And they shouldn't be proud of that because it really is dividing America in some really fundamental valences. But it was effective, okay? It wasn't ineffective because clearly he is the president to be and Kamala Harris is not. But that's a really terrific question, Ingrid. It's going to take a lot of work. We're going to have to focus on this one a lot. And you'll be hearing more about it, about this from us as we go forward. Because again, we like to think that the Lincoln Project is a very effective messaging machine. And we are. False modesty is the worst kind. And we're looking for ways that it's going to change the political chemistry in this country before 2026 and certainly before 2028. So with that, folks, I want to wrap up this episode of Q&A from the Lincoln Project. Again, we're going to do this more often because people really seem to like them. Email podcast@lincolnproject.us with your questions for the next time we do this. I don't know how often it's going to be. It might be once every 2 weeks. It might be once every 4 weeks. It might be once every 6 weeks. But we have a pile of questions right now I couldn't even get to today. But look forward to answering them on the next edition of the Q&A with the Lincoln Project. Thanks, everybody.
The Lincoln Project podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joseph Werner-Chaney. Produced and edited by Whitney Hayes and Jeff Taylor.
And good luck.
Hey, everybody, if you would like to get in touch, if you have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just general questions, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. That's podcast@lincolnproject.us.